Srimad Bhagavatam class, Denver, Colorado, Sunday, June 9th. Yoga of the tongue.
Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Gopremanande, Hari Hari Bo. We're speaking about the yoga of the tongue, and all the revealed scriptures and great acharyas point to the tongue as the primary sense that if one is able to control, one can control all the other senses. Oftentimes in the practice of some system or philosophy, there's a tendency to philosophize and not to apply. But application is everything. There's applied math and pure math. There's, I almost cooked you dinner, and I actually cooked you dinner. And which is better? The application always brings wonderful rewards, and simply philosophizing or almost doing something doesn't. And in the practice of yoga, there are many points at which one may begin to practice. However, the Padma Purana says, Atashi Krishna Namani Nabhav Head Krayam Indriye Seva Mukhi Hijivado Swayameva Spratyada. Start with the tongue. Jiva Adao. Jiha means the tongue, and Adao means first. So first start with the tongue. It's the gateway to all the other senses. Similarly, in the Nectar of Instruction, Rupa Goswami begins, Vacho Vegam Manasakroda Vegam Jiha Vegam Udaropasta Vegam. Itan vegam yo visheheta dhira sarvamapimam prithivim sashishyat. That all the senses have their urges and they run in a straight line. So starting with the tongue, the urge to speak and the tongue's desire to taste many different things. If we control these two things, this is what I'm postulating, then all the other senses will come into line. And according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, if one has conquered all the other senses but has not conquered the tongue, then one's practice is incomplete and will unravel at some point. So the tongue, it must become our friend and must be engaged properly. So yesterday we talked a little bit about mantra, and the tongue likes to taste something nice, and the mantra actually tastes good. The tongue likes to chant the mantra. In fact, if anyone has practiced chanting all day long, the Hare Krishna mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, or at least chant 64 rounds, you'll notice that after you stop 64 rounds, the tongue will continue. It will keep chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. It gets a taste for it, and it becomes accustomed to it. At the same time, the mantra is very powerful. The sound vibration created by the mantra is going into the ears, entering to the heart, and it's transforming our entire being, beginning with our consciousness. Our chitta becomes purified by that vibration. So the mantra is extremely important in controlling the tongue. And if we, in the beginning, regulate the tongue by chanting mantras every day, the tongue will get a taste for it, and simultaneously the vibration of the mantra will purify our hearts. And we talked about Shastra Yoni Dvat. This is an aphorism, a code from the Vedanta Sutra, that says that The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the mother of all the Vedas. That is, they all come from Krishna. So they're transcendental. So if you connect with the mantra, you're connecting with Krishna. And Tarko Pratishtanat means don't spend a lot of time arguing about things because there's no resolution, there's no ultimate standing place. And Shutes Tu Shabda Mudvat Vat, the Supreme Personality of God, it can be understood by the Vedas. So there is a way that the Supreme Personality of God, it is revealed, and it's through the Vedic mantras. He can be understood in that way. And finally, Anavritti Shabdat means liberation by sound. We become entangled in the material world by sound vibration, and we similarly become liberated and make progress in spiritual life by the power of sound. And I want to read you one of my favorite purports from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is a verse from 3rd Canto, 26th chapter, 32nd verse. The reason I'm reading this is because Prabhupada so eloquently describes how sound vibration is the source of everything in the material world. Lord Kapiladev speaking, when egoism in ignorance is agitated by the sex energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the subtle element sound is manifested, and from sound come the ethereal sky and the sense of hearing. Purport. It appears from this verse that all the objects of our sense gratification are the products of egoism and ignorance. It is understood from this verse that by agitation of the element of egoism and ignorance, the first thing produced was sound, which is the subtle form of ether. It is stated also in the Vedanta Sutra that sound is the origin of all objects of material possession, and that by sound one can also dissolve this material existence. Anavritti Shabdat means liberation by sound. The entire material manifestation began from sound, and sound can also end material entanglement if it has a particular potency. The particular sound capable of doing this is the transcendental vibration, Hare Krishna. Our entanglement in material affairs has begun from material sound. Now we must purify that sound in spiritual understanding. There is sound in the spiritual world also. If we approach that sound, then our spiritual life begins and the other requirements for spiritual advancement can be supplied. We have to understand very clearly that sound is the beginning of the creation of all material objects for our sense gratification. Similarly, if sound is purified, our spiritual necessities also are produced from sound. Here it is said that from sound the ether became manifested and that the air became manifested from ether. How the ethereal sky comes from sound, how the air comes from sky, and how fire comes from air will be explained later on. Sound is the cause of the sky, and sky is the cause of shrotram, the ear. The ear is the first sense for receiving knowledge. One must give oral reception to any knowledge one wants to receive, either material or spiritual. Therefore, shrotram is very important. The Vedic knowledge is called shruti. Called what?
Shruti.
Knowledge has to be received by hearing. By hearing only, we can achieve, by hearing only can we have access to either material or spiritual enjoyment. In the material world, we manufacture many things for our material comfort simply by hearing. They are already there, but just by hearing, one can transform them. If we want to build a very high skyscraper, this does not mean that we have to create it. The materials for the skyscraper, wood, metal, earth, etc., are already there. But we make our intimate relationship with those already created material elements by hearing how to utilize them. Modern economic advancement for creation is also a product of hearing. And similarly, one can create a favorable field of spiritual activities by hearing from the right source. Arjuna was a gross materialist in the bodily conception of life and was suffering from the bodily concept very acutely. But simply by hearing, Arjuna became a spiritualized Krishna-conscious person. Hearing is very important, and that hearing is produced from the sky. By hearing only can we make proper use of that which already exists. The principle of hearing to properly utilize preconceived materials is applicable to spiritual paraphernalia as well. We must hear from the proper spiritual source. So, this sound of the mantra comes down through a disciplic succession. We call sampradaya, means the complete gift. That sound vibration that we receive enables us to fully realize our eternal relationship with Krishna. And when we take the sound through that channel and practice following in the footsteps of the previous teachers, all success is guaranteed. Even if we have little or no qualification, Shastra says, Bejare Muniyo Tagre Bhagavantamadhoksajam Satvam Bishudham Shemaya Kalpanteyi Nutaniha. That what previously the sages who were very qualified did to attain perfection in spiritual life, if we follow that, we'll also become eligible for the same result, even if we're not sages, whatever position one starts from, simply by following in their footsteps. We also talked about how the tongue is a rudder, and the direction that we go in life is much dependent on our speech. What kind of vibration we're making using our tongue will direct us in a certain way. And if the tongue is unbridled, then our life will be unbridled also. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu very much emphasized this liberation by sound. And first off, the phrase cheto darpana marjana means that the consciousness must be cleansed. So cheto means consciousness, just like chitta. And he compares it to a mirror. If the mirror of the consciousness is distorted, then our image of ourselves and the world will also be distorted. I was flying in an airline, and I went into into the restroom, and I looked in the mirror. I'd just woken up. It was a long flight. And I looked in the mirror, and I said, oh my goodness, my head is now lopsided. And I became alarmed. I thought, how will I present myself from now on? I look like a freak. And I was momentarily very concerned until I moved my face just a little bit more to the right and I saw that it was a blemish in the mirror that was distorting my image. Shankaracharya gives a similar example when he talks about how when one looks into a sword, apparently they didn't have proper mirrors at that time, so he used this example. A sword, shiny, reflects the face and it elongates it because of the shape of the sword. So one may look at in the sword, see one's reflection and think, oh, my face is very long and skinny now. So in many ways, we're looking at the world and we're looking at ourselves through a mirror that's distorted. And we're seeing what is not actually there. We're seeing a distorted vision of the world. But through sound, by the use of the tongue, through the mantra, through the Sankirtan, one cleanses the mirror, actually clarifies it, and when the mirror is clarified, the chitta, the consciousness, is clear of any obstruction, then one can see oneself properly. The other benefits of the mantra is that bhava mahad lavagni nirvapanam, the fire of material life is extinguished. Prabhupada noted in New York City, all the time the fire brigade is coming. You can hear the sound from here also, a couple blocks away. Always everything's burning. Fire is just waiting to come out. some here, there, and everywhere. And similarly, our material bodies are actually burning. If you take your temperature, you'll notice it's 98.6. At least that's fairly normal. That's pretty hot. And biological bodies are burning organisms, and this organism will burn itself out. And then, because of my impure consciousness, I'll take on another burning organism. So one great devotee had once compared this to chain smoking, the process of samsara. That means taking one birth after another. I'm burning this body up. And then I die, and I take on another body out of attachment. So it's like a chain smoker finishes one cigarette, and he lights with the stub of that burning cigarette, the next cigarette begins smoking. This is samsara. I die burning up, and I start again burning up. So Bhava Maha Davagni Nirvapanam means the sound vibration of Hare Krishna mantra, the Sankirtan, it extinguishes that forest fire of material existence. No more burning. The burning of the heart and the burning of the body, one receives relief. Shreya Kairava Chandrika Vitaranam Vidya Vidu Jivanam. So this is very poetical. We'll see that in this phrase that the chanting of Hare Krishna mantra, it spreads the rays of the benediction moon, and it opens the white lotus of good fortune. Now, wouldn't you want the white lotus of good fortune to bloom in your life? It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? May the white lotus of good fortune bloom in your life. You can tell that to someone today. Call your mom or somebody and say, may the white lotus of good fortune bloom in your life. White lotus is very interesting because actually it blooms at night. Most lotuses only bloom in the day with the intense heat of the sun. And in the Kali Yuga, it's like night. Prayanal parishashabhya kalavasmin yuge jana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya hyut padrita. In the Iron Age of Kali, men have but short lives. They're quarrelsome, lazy, misguided, unlucky, and above all, always disturbed. It's the dark age of Kali Yuga. But there's one great thing about this age, that the white lotus of good fortune blooms in the darkness when the moon comes up. And this chanting, the mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, that's the moonlight that opens the white lotus of good fortune. The great gift of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda, who appeared like the sun and the moon on the horizon of Gauda. And this Vidya Vidu Jivana means naturally knowledge comes. The Sankirtan is the wife of transcendental knowledge. It means when you're chanting, then automatically knowledge, detachment, everything else will be there. They're servants of bhakti, which is manifest through the sincere chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. When the living entity, when a baby, I should say, comes into this world, he's wondering, is it safe? Comes out and he's looking around, is it safe? Is there peace here? Is there any happiness? And we have to honestly tell him, not much, unless you're connected to this transcendental sound vibration. A very precarious, dangerous environment, the material world. So the mantra, it brings this light, and it brings the peace everyone's looking for, and it brings fearlessness. Only through this transcendental sound can this come. Anandam Buddhivardhanam means the downpour of blissful nectar is served to the soul who has been thirsty since a time immemorial. And, of course, material life is a great burden, and when that burden is lifted, one immediately becomes happy. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told a story about a poor man. He was suffering because he had no money and no means in life, no future. And then he was visited by the great astrologer, Sarvagya. Sarvagya could tell past, present, future through his astrology. And he sat down with the poor man and he read his chart. He said, by golly, you're not poor at all. You're actually the richest man in the land because your father was the richest man in the world and he left you his treasure when he died. You were estranged from him You didn't even know that he passed away and left you all this fortune, and all this time you've been suffering needlessly. How long does it take for the poor man to suddenly feel happy? Oops, I gave it away. How long does it take for a poor man who finds out that he's rich to change his attitude in life? Approximately. How long? Instantaneously, 1 second. Is that, do you all agree? So the news of the Vedas is bringing us this information. You're not poor. You have nothing to do with this material world. Our only connection to the material world is our attachment to it, says the Vedas. Asango kyayam purushaha. Asango, we have no real sangha with the material world. But because I'm attached to it, I maintain some residence here and some idea that this is important to me. But actually, it's a great burden. So the sound vibration of the mantra liberates us from that conception. Brahma bhuta prasanatma na shochati na kangshati samak sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. When one comes to the spiritual platform, then one becomes happy, joyful, immediately joyful, and sees the equality, true equality of all living beings, and no longer hankers and laments. In this stage, one can attain the pure devotion to Krishna. Sarvatma snapanam param bijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. So, Thakur Haridas said that all souls are benefited by the sound of the mantra. When one employs the tongue in chanting the mantra, especially loudly, Haridas Thakur emphasized, then not only do human beings who hear the mantra become benefited, but also other living entities like trees and bugs, and what else is there?
Fish.
Worms, fish,
squirrels.
Birds, monkeys, plants, aardvarks, badgers, microbes. They all become benefited with the mantra. Once there was a devotee who was in a coma, and a group of devotees went to see her, and the doctor said, oh, you know, she's not responding, she can't hear you anyway. And the devotees went and started chanting. Immediately she replied. So her question to the doctor is, how do you know she can't hear? The soul can hear the transcendental vibration of the mantra. What to speak of one who's consciously ingesting the mantra through the ears, using the tongue for this purpose. It benefits all living entities, and one becomes purified in body, mind, and intelligence. So, this is the verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam I referred to earlier. If one can control the tongue, it is possible for one to control the other senses. And in his prayers, Bhaktivinoda Thakur exalts the bhakti yogi who honors prasadam. And he says in one of his prayers, you know, there's a group of prayers that go along with Sharira Vijajal. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote about 8 separate prayers that you can sing before, during, and after taking prasadam. And in one of those prayers, he says what a yogi attains after 10,000 years of meditation. Today we will attain at one time by sitting down to honor prasadam. This is the power of honoring prasadam. So, chanting the mantra and taking prasadam. These two very appealing activities bring the highest benefit. And we don't simply leave the tongue to languish with no activity, but we engage it in these two activities. And this is application. Now, if you just take Krishna prasadam, if you restrict yourself to only honoring those things that have been offered to Krishna, then you'll notice that you'll always be thinking of Krishna because you're honoring the food that it's coming from his mercy. And if you restrict your tongue to speaking about topics that are related to Krishna and chanting the mantra, your consciousness will also be clarified and purified by that activity. So these two things. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends the austerities of speech. Truthfulness. Now, you can take a vow to be completely truthful for how long? 24 hours. Just see what happens. Notice what happens when you tell the truth. And don't take anything away from it. One thing is that in truthfulness, that you don't have to make up for other things that you've said before. You just say what's the truth. And Krishna also said speech should be pleasing. There's mention of how Krishna's speech was pleasing when he chastised the Kaliya serpent. And he was so kind in his speech to Kaliya that everyone was amazed that his speech was accommodating for this serpent who had contaminated the Jamuna. Dishonesty is sticky. It means that we have to make up for what we've said before. And beneficial, speaking of words that are beneficial for others, and non-agitating, and also regular recitation of the Vedas. So these are the five austerities of speech. One's to speak truthfully, beneficially, avoiding speech which offends, and should be pleasing, and also one should regularly recite the Vedas. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu met the Digvijay Pandit in Navadvip, he was a extremely learned person who had a benediction from Saraswati that whenever he would debate with someone, he would be able to defeat them. And he was traveling all over India, defeating everyone, and he had a sheet that they would sign after they were defeated. And he was traveling with an entourage on an elephant and very puffed up about his position of learning and scholarship. And he was on his way to Navadvip, which was known as a seat of learning, and there were many great Brahmins there, very learned. And of course, this is where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. And as a young boy in Navadvip, he was a great scholar. He used to go up and down the Ganges with some of his friends, and he would meet other boys who were learning from teachers, and he would challenge them to debate, even though he was much younger. And they would say, "Why are you so puffed up, always picking a fight?" And he said, "Just answer my questions and let's see." And then they would enter into some debate, and he would defeat their argument soundly. And then they would, in an amazed way, say, "You're so learned. How did you become like that?" And then he would say, "Actually, what I have presented is not correct." And then he'd defeat his own argument. And in this way, he would leave them with their heads spinning, and he would go on to the next group and defeat the next group, the next group. And he got a huge following of students. They all wanted to be around Nimai Pandit and hear how he would defeat others and hear his great scholarship. They were learning from him. And now the residents of Navadvip heard that the Digvijay Pandit was on his way to defeat everyone in Navadvip. So many of them, on the excuse that they had to go out of town for some reason, left. However, Nimai Pandit, he set himself on the bank of the Ganges with all the students, anticipating the arrival of the Digvijay, who came with his entourage, and just as he was entering Navadvip, he saw the beautiful Nimai Pandit sitting in the middle of all his students. And he was stunned to see his beauty, so he stopped and he asked, "Who is this?" They said, "Nimai Pandit." And Nimai Pandit welcomed him to Navadvip and then asked him, "Please, tell us something amazing. Give us some of your poetry." And the Digvijay Pandit spontaneously, extemporaneously composed 100 Sanskrit verses in perfect meter, glorifying Mother Ganges. And he recited them like the blowing wind. In his head, he composed them just within a few moments. And then Nimai Pandit said, "Now let's analyze these verses. Let's see what are all the good points, and then we'll look at some of the points that we can criticize." And the Digvijay Pandit became indignant. He said, "Criticize? There's nothing to criticize in my poetry. And besides, you're not even qualified to look at it. You're just a simple student of grammar. What can you know about my poetry?" And Nimai Pandit said, "No, let's analyze it. Let's have a look. Because it's very beautiful poetry, but..." And then he picked out one verse, and he recited the verse, and the Digvijay Pandit said, "How did you remember that one verse out of 100? I recited them like the blowing wind." And Nimai Pandit said, "Some people have the ability to compose poetry like you, and others are shrutidars. They can remember everything they hear. I just have this God-given talent, that's all." And then he dissected the verse and showed all the defects in the grammar that the Digvijay Pandit had presented. And when the Digvijay tried to defend himself, no words would come out. He was stunned. And now the students around were about to laugh, and they just started to giggle to see how soundly Nimai Pandit had defeated this great scholar. And he stopped them. He said, "Don't laugh. He's a great scholar." And very gently, he encouraged the Digvijay. He said, "You just had a bad day." He said, "You know, go take rest. Come back. We'll talk about this tomorrow." So Digvijay went away demoralized, mortified. And that night, he was praying to his goddess, Saraswati, who had given him a benediction that she would appear on his tongue whenever he would debate. He said, "How have you forsaken me?" And in his dream, she revealed to him that actually Nimai Pandit is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I couldn't say anything in front of him. And she said, "You've received the ultimate fruit of all your studies. You've actually met the Supreme Personality of Godhead." Sarvasya chaham ridisani vishto matak smitir gyanam apohanam cha vedashta sarver ahame vivedyo vedanta kridveda videva chaham. The ultimate goal of all the Vedas is to know Krishna. So she told him, you've attained something extraordinary. And in thinking about his exchange with the Digvijay Pandit, with Nimai Pandit, the Digvijay considered that he didn't allow the students to laugh. And he spoke to me in such a soothing way after soundly defeating me. He didn't try to rub it in. Now, normally, when somebody has a victory, they rub it in. They gloat out of envy. But he felt none of that from Nimai Pandit. And besides the fact that Saraswati had revealed to him that he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead and that no one could be that learned and remember a verse out of the 100 that he had recited, he was most impressed by the fact that Nimai Pandit was so gentle and that he didn't try to demoralize him after he had defeated him. So he went back the next day to the house of Nimai Pandit. And Nimai Pandit came out and offered him respects and said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And Digvijay said, "I know who you are." And he offered his obeisance to Nimai Pandit. And Nimai Pandit blessed him. After that, the Digvijay gave up his elephant, he gave up his entourage, and he simply wandered a happy person throughout India with no more pretense. And in this story especially, the fact that Nimai Pandit had used this event to curb the pride of the Digvijay Pandit, but that he wasn't envious of him. He didn't do it to ruin him, but he did it to benefit him, is a very powerful indication of purified speech without envy, speaking for the benefit of others. And this is the nature of pleasing speech and the austerity of speech when one speaks for the benefit of others. There are practical things. I've mentioned taking Krishna prasadam. That is, if you just do this one thing, and that is, before eating, offer the food that you take to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The tongue and stomach say, do it, just take it now. And even the few minutes that it takes to offer something to Krishna may seem like 10,000 years to the tongue and mind. But in that practice, one actually purifies one's consciousness, one purifies the tongue. And this is the austerity of the tongue that's very much applicable to our daily lives, because everyone has to eat. And if you center your household around this principle of only taking food which is first offered to Krishna, then very quickly one can come to realize the higher stages of devotional service. The others is reciting the Vedas regularly. So we have all these books, like the Bhagavad Gita is especially potent. And if you chant one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day, there are many benedictions that come from that. One becomes very learned, one clarifies one's intelligence, and one begins to develop an intimate relationship with Krishna, who's actually directly speaking in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada many times, multiple times, requested that we recite one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day. Do you believe that? I'll give you proof. Someone can pass these out. This is an invitation to join an international secret organization called CHAD, C-H-A-D, which stands for Chapter a Day. And all you have to do is begin this process of chanting one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day. You can sing just the Sanskrit or just the English or both, and you'll be a member of the organization. You'll also see a link on this card to a website which gives a lot of the evidence I was just presenting for the benefits of chanting one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day. Try this. One thing that you can do is you can make a copy of one chapter. I have in my bag here a copy of the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which I'm presently working on. And I printed it out with the Sanskrit verses, the word for word, and the English translation. And just in waiting for people to get off the airplane, between the time that we land and the time that everyone gets off the airplane, I can pretty much finish one chapter. And I notice what everyone else is doing. They're kind of looking down the aisleway thinking, when are we going to move? And I'm thinking, take your time to move, because I have about 10 more verses to go. This is light. It's easy to carry. And also on the back, another thing that I like to do, you'll notice there's a little bit of handwriting on the back of the page. Every time I complete the chapter, I write down the date and where I was when I completed the chapter. It keeps an amazing map, too, of where you've been and when you've been there. And there's an impetus to finish your chapter every day and keep a record of it. We also have a chart available on our website called fanthespark.com, which is called Be a Sage Page by Page. And there it shows how many pages a day you need to read in order to complete all of the various books that Prabhupada published. For instance, if you read 40 pages of Bhagavatam every day, you'll complete the whole book in 1 year. But if that's too much, you can extend it to 5 years because you're going to be 5 years older in 5 years anyway. And if you just start a regimented practice of reading a certain number of pages every day, you'll get great advancement in the process of spiritual life. Another recommendation that is practical is to study and employ nonviolent communication. Actually, there's a book about nonviolent communication. There's a couple of books now, and there's a website that there's a lot about it. You can Google and look at nonviolent communication. I'm not going to go into it right now because there's not enough time, but I encourage you to look at it. It's a whole different way of speaking and communicating with others, and it gives tools through which you can actually employ the austerities of speech. Nonviolent communication means, just briefly, to learn how to communicate in such a way that you get across your point without agitating the mind of the other person, and avoiding words that tend to sabotage the point that you're trying to make. Like, "You always do that." Now, that's not true, because no one always does anything. But if you do that again, I'm never going to, you know, there are certain things that we say that tend to paint us into a corner, ultimatums and so forth, and ways in which we speak to other people when we're making a point that sabotage our purpose. So nonviolent communication I recommend as a practical means to employ the austerities of speech. Also, I recommend, I may be preaching to the choir here, probably am, but a news fast. The news cycle is meant to agitate the mind. In fact, journalism in general is, if you'll notice how headlines are made and what goes on the front page, if it bleeds, it leads. It has to, because that's what attracts people's attention, and they have to sell newspapers and advertising and so forth. So what you're getting if you listen to the news or read the news and so forth is expert writers who know exactly how to agitate your mind so you read a little bit more. And it's not necessary. I have a system that works well for me. I'm not saying you have to adopt it, but I can tell you that it works, and that is I don't look at the news at all. But if something's important, it rises to a certain threshold where I'll hear about it on the street. I'll hear about it getting off the airplane. People will just be talking about it. That's the level it'll rise to. And so, oh, okay, I probably needed to know about that. New York City's on fire. Okay. People are talking about it, and it's something in the news. But the news cycle goes on 24 hours a day, and there's multiple channels that are broadcasting news, multiple newspapers. And this comes in the category of what Rupa Goswami calls prajalpa. It's unnecessary talk. And when you hear it, you'll repeat it. Because in the gap, when you're sitting with somebody, you'll think, well, what are we going to talk about? Dad, you hear about that shooting? And then you're agitating the mind. What is the necessity of going into it when you can actually direct your speech in another way and you're hearing in another way? So if you try a news fast, don't consume any of it and just see what comes to the threshold where you hear about it on the street. You'll find that your tongue is more controlled, your mind is more controlled. And now we'll take some reflections and any questions. Yes, Prabhu. Do we have the microphone? Sorry to interrupt you.
If you'll allow me just for a moment to pray that the old ask God, it's not just me.
Yes.
In the beginning, you talked about the tongue developing a taste in that Chinese system for and talked about the science of mantra meditation, really, you know, by sound meditation. It really sounds to me that. It really sounds like, to an outside, it sounds like brainwashing. Why would you say that?
Well, the brain needs washing. So that's a good thing. Brain is generally full of all kinds of contamination. So the mantra is a pure vibration and it cleans the brain. So we like that.
No, but I mean like, traditionally speaking, when people want to, like, people want to mislead, like, media wants to mislead people because they're just doing it as all, for example.
I don't think they...
You get the same message over and over to get you to believe in something.
Sure. I don't notice that they do that much anymore. Back in the 80s, people talked about bhakti yoga and yogis being brainwashed and so forth. And there was a big move to deprogram devotees. You know this, right? In the early 80s, there was a movement. Huh? 70s and early 80s. Okay, we have a testimonial here. Pass the microphone. A lot of devotees were kidnapped, and then they tried to put all the stuff back in their brain that they had purified. But nowadays, I think that there's much more talk about the benefits of spiritual life. I notice that more than ever, people appreciate when they see someone who's dedicated to a spiritual discipline in a non-fanatical way. Nowadays, I think fanaticism is anathema more than the idea that one is disciplining oneself in a certain practice. Whereas previously, you know, even if you were in some kind of discipline, people would look at it askance. Okay?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've noticed, too, that even in the corporate world, where everything's all about money, they actually start to appreciate and recognize the certain benefits of, you know, like meditation and, you know, time, you know, the simple little basic things like time off kind of things, just because it seems to function better within the corporation. You know, people, when they feel better about themselves, when they function better.
Yeah. Very true. Nice point. More reflections? That is one thing that you heard in the last 2 days that stuck in your mind that you're taking with you. Nirkula.
You mentioned spending the day chanting. And when we went to the Japa retreat, we did a day of mantra, which is a day of no talking. We just chant 64 rounds. And how nice that was. It was not just that we chanted the 64 rounds, but that there was no communication within the large group that we were with. No notes passed, nothing like that. And how much that helped to make the mind peaceful.
I remember that after that, we were talking the next day, and Giriraj Maharaj, who was there, said he appreciated the fact that he didn't have to think about how to respond to people. Because when someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, how are you doing?" Then you have to think, "I don't know. What am I going to say? What am I supposed to say?" And it takes a lot of energy to think about how to interact and how to answer people and things like that. When you're given permission not to talk all day long, and it was very interesting. This goes to the power of the tongue and its urge to speak. I remember before the retreat, everyone was informed that there would be one day of no talking, only chanting. And many people said, "Everything I can do except this no talking." They couldn't imagine not talking for one day to other people. For one day, not talking. And when you stop talking for one day and only chant, and of course we're not advocating that to do every day, but as a practice, you can see how much the tongue is urging us to speak. Or that urge to speak is there and it gets manifest through the tongue. And it makes you more conscious of what you say. Nice point, Nirkula, thank you. Other reflections?
Well, you're speaking about Sampradaya as the gift, and I was thinking that this is something we need to reflect on, because
often we're not grateful enough for the gifts that we were given by this Sampradaya to Prabhupada in the civil succession. And then when we appreciate it and have gratitude for it and see what it is more and more, then we become so want to treasure it and share it. So I was thinking of that, and that's so valuable.
Thank you very much. Excellent point.
I was just reflecting on what you've been speaking about since you've been in town. And yesterday I was spending time with my home family, which is all my roommates and friends. And I'm always working, I'm always looking at myself, of course, and being aware of myself. And even just yesterday I let something roll off my tongue that might have been a little harsh. And I actually felt a bit of anxiety after it came out of my mouth. And, just some things that annoy me about this person, and how they speak with other people, and I made a point to address that. But the way that I did it, actually, you talk about how envy is closing the heart, I actually kind of felt that way as I pointed out to this person. I could have obviously pointed it out in a much more loving way, but I found that within me, just that nerve that was struck, and I lashed out in a way, and it was actually kind of humbling to immediately feel that I felt anxiety and a lack of love immediately after I had said that. So it's definitely a great thing that you're teaching here, yoga of the tongue, because I don't really think I've ever noticed anyone put that much emphasis on it.
Thank you. That's a very powerful realization, practical, that you actually experienced it. And when you said that, I was thinking about how, especially nowadays with the internet and the way things are digitized, it's very dangerous to speak out of anger. And typing can be speaking also. For instance, if you type something out of a reaction. For instance, you might get an email and it agitates your mind and you think, there's that impulse to react. And then you type don't push the button. Previously, you'd write a letter and then, it would take till the next day. It was nighttime, so you couldn't mail it anyway, hopefully. And the next day, you'd think about it a little bit. It's like, it wasn't so bad, Or else they'd call and give a retraction, They'd call and say, that was a mistake, But now, if you say something on the internet, it's there eternally. It never goes away. Whatever is there eternally. It'll never go away. It's always stored in that Akashic record on the internet. And so especially, it's amplified now. What you said in a moment of anger and typed and put out there is very, very dangerous. So I always make it a point, if I feel that urge to respond out of reaction, I say, don't push the button. Wait till much, much later, and then look at it objectively and see what happens. Thank you for that point. Yes, Adam.
I think another aspect of yoga of the tongue is also what I mean in yesterday's speech, being truthful but not, because I see myself a lot of times I can have this autopilot kind of responding and autopilot kind of actions, and especially with speaking or just in conversation with people. You're becoming impersonal and like retracting from interacting with somebody, and then you just have automated responses a lot of times. And so, and how that can affect others, how that impersonal interaction can affect others, and how it affects myself. So maybe you can say something about that.
Well, when you said automated speech, I notice it all the time. Like if you go to the store, the people are checking you out, and they go, so how are you today? And it's like, terrible, oh, that's great, They don't even listen. But if most people just say the same thing. It's just sort of a a social custom to say, how are you? I'm fine. If you say something different, it really shakes people up sometimes. They say, you know, how are you? And you say, I'm grateful. And that suddenly they have to process that whole thing, say something more specific that isn't just automatic. But it does go to the point that we often tend to say things without really thinking about them, just automatically say them, not very thoughtful. Yes.
If we're not good readers and we don't retain what we read, I'm intimidated by the idea of reading a whole chapter or 40 pages or even one page every single day. I do read it, but I don't remember tomorrow what I read yesterday. What can we do about that?
Well, when
is it back?
Just listen to Amala Bhakta. Every time I see Amala Bhakta, I say, Amala Bhakta, we're never separated. I'm always with you. Because I'm always listening to Amala Bhakta. He recites he reads verbatim the books, you know, Prabhupada has written, so you can listen to them on tape. Yeah, do that. Yeah, everyone has a different... Writing is for Kali Yuga anyway, because people can't remember anything. Previously, it was all just by oral tradition. People would listen, and then they would remember. Even just, you know, in the Rupa Goswami, the way he was writing things was, he had one shot, because he was writing on these palm leaves, and he didn't get to use a word processor. And people would remember things. Yeah, so do whatever works for you.
Sleep on your letter.
Thank you. Nice points. Thank you very much. A couple more. We've got Tulsi over here. Tulsi Balaba Prabhu.
On the positive side of the word, we're talking about the not educated and not violent communication. And one thing I've been reflecting is, you are also talking about the prasada and seeing. So there is a quality of seeing that interaction or what you learn, the more on the grateful side, like cultivation of some gratitude. God removes you from the negative platform of judging or interacting in a negative way so that you can appreciate it. So I thought if you could share some of that.
Well, one thing is in our book distribution seminar, and when we, one of the services that Nirkula and I do is we travel around and help to set up teams of devotees who are doing Sankirtan together. And one of the mantras that we propagate is encourage the heck out of everybody. And this is a kind of practice that, actually there was a book in the early 80s called The 1 Minute Manager. Anybody ever see this? The 1 Minute Manager... The author emphasized that in management, you should go around and catch people doing something right. And when you do, then give them a 1 minute praising, you know, and appreciate what they're doing right. And in that kind of atmosphere, people are always looking to do something right. And also, another seminar that we present is the seminar called Prachodayat, The Art of Encouragement. This word prachodayat comes in the Gayatri Mantra, and it means to take encouragement and to accept encouragement coming down to us, and also to pass that encouragement on. And courage, the word, comes from kor, which means the heart. What we hold in our heart. There's a verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita in which the author says, may the lion-like Lord Chaitanya, by his loud roaring, scare away all the anartas, the unwanted things within one's heart. The way the loud roaring of a lion scares away even elephants, they go running away. So one may have elephantine vices within one's heart, but the loud roaring of Lord Chaitanya will scare them away. And so Everyone needs courage because the material world is a daunting place. It's a place where we're constantly getting discouragement, not only from the outside environment, but also from the voice within one's head. I recently listened to a very famous author give a commencement speech at a university, and he was talking about how when he became very successful, he wasn't ready for it, and that he realized throughout his life people had prepared him for failure, but never for success. And that as he was becoming more and more successful, he imagined in his mind that he had this imaginary figure that would come to his door with a clipboard and say, "All right, we know you're really no good. You give it all back now." And that voice is there within the head and the heart that's always trying to discourage us and say, "Don't go forward." This is what Prabhupada categorizes in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as weakness of heart. Weakness of heart. And he says one must overcome this weakness of heart in order to move forward in devotional service. And so our community, our society of devotees, is meant to create an atmosphere of encouragement, prachodayat. So we should go out of our way to encourage people. As we started the seminar, one sentence, well-meaning sentence, which is apt and it is presented in because someone actually deserves it, some encouragement, can uplift somebody in ways we can't even imagine. It can keep them going for years or even a lifetime. So we should take the time out to notice what people are doing nicely and encourage them. Peter Burwash, who gives a talk sometimes in the Festival of Inspiration, actually I wasn't even supposed to say that, because anyway, he talks about this in his corporation, which has been one of the most successful worldwide corporations, one of the best managed corporations according to corporate standards in the world. And he emphasizes this culture of encouragement, that find out what people are doing right and take time to appreciate them for it. And I notice him when he comes into a devotee community, he goes around after he takes prasadam, he goes up to everyone who served prasadam and says, "Thank you very much, you did a great job." A lot of times people just, you know, they take prasadam, they eat, they go away. But they don't go back and they don't find out who's the cook, who did all this, who cleaned up afterwards. You know, what if the garland makers, you know, people came in and said, "We really appreciate the service you're doing." And this kind of culture, if you encourage the heck out of everybody, and heck gets in people, so it's not very good, you can scare it away. And then this is what keeps a volunteer organization going, is this kind of encouragement. So it's a very nice point. And now we have one last point. Yes.
Thank you. I was here on Friday, and after the class, I gave you gratitude and thanks. And I said it was very timely. And I teach a class on Saturdays, a yoga class, to disabled individuals at a hospital. And I use what I learned from you in the class. And many times it's not what we actually say to others, it's also what we say to ourselves, to this being. And many times when individuals have a disability or illness, they are very hard on themselves. And so we dedicated our class yesterday to whenever a thought comes up that is not pleasant about self, "I can't do this. Why can't I do this?" Getting frustrated with self because they're paralyzed and they can't move their leg. But I have them walk them through envisioning pressing through the sole of their foot into the palm of my hand. And when they start having those thoughts of "I can't do this," or "I'm too tired," frustrated, "Why is this happening to me?" I ask them to just pause and take a deep breath. Allow that thought to just go away. And so I just wanted to thank you, because a lot of times it's also what we say to others, but also what we say to ourselves that can be so harmful to ourselves. So thank you.
Thank you very much for another practical application and realization that we can all live by. Thank you very much, everyone, for the last few days. This is a vibrant, beautiful community that you have here. I was appreciating this morning how all the devotees are coming here in such big numbers to take part in this authorized process of bhakti yoga, which is passed down to us through Lord Chaitanya and his disciples and followers in disciple succession. And it's a real joy to be here, to see what you've created. It's a miracle, actually, that we can all come together in one place. It's a miracle that we have the books that we have. It's a miracle that the deities are here. I was thinking that this morning, and that all this environment is maintained by devotees who have faith in their heart in the process and who are cooperating together. So we can never take it for granted. And I always tell the devotees in our community, every time we successfully come together for a class, it's a miracle that we're all here. Because it's just like, it's a miracle the body works. Every time I wake up in the morning, I think, nothing went wrong. You know, I can actually wake up and walk around and see and everything like that. Because there's so many things that can go wrong. And in a community like this, there's so many things that can go wrong also. So when the devotees have the courage to get up and come in and be with one another and actually make the practice together, that's a miracle. And we should appreciate it that we're here, and we should appreciate all the devotees that are here. So go on with the practice of using the tongue to make others advance in Krishna consciousness and make yourself advance in Krishna consciousness. And relish and honor Krishna Prasadam whenever you have the opportunity. Go premanande adibo vancha kalpadrubascha kripasanabe vajapatitanam pavanebyo vaishnavebyo namo namaha.